appreciate the invitation to speak at this meeting. And one thing about this particular disease problem, coming into it, I never made any grand promises. In fact, it's a very humbling disease. And I look at the history of controlling this disease over the past century, and you can't help but feel humbled by it. I'd also like to take the opportunity to thank my cooperators, Rick Minzenmeyer, Jeff Stopper, IPM and county agent, and Chris Sansone, extension entomologist. Without these people and other people, I really couldn't do the work I do, so I really do appreciate that support. And from other people, I appreciate the encouragement to get into this, and I'm mainly into this because it is the big grower problem on cotton in Texas. And you can't really ignore that. And plus, once I became to full professor rank, I really had nothing left to lose by going into this. So here I am. As Dr. Riggs spoke about earlier, there's been many different approaches for controlling this disease. And a lot of this work was done in the heyday back in the 1920s and 1930s, and there wasn't really a lot of new work related to organic amendments and such since then. Now, I'll go into a little bit more detail about the use of chemicals to control this disease. Now, I look at it as two different periods. The early period, and actually since the discovery of this disease, people have been looking at soil treatments. 1892, kerosene, formaldehyde is something that's very popular. Apparently it does work, but you have to use massive quantities of it. Work done in the 1930s in Texas by Ezekiel, looking at mercury and volatile organics like xylene. And then still later, people were looking at other materials, Bailey's Leaf and Westlico with various fungicides and fumigants to treat the soil. And of course, Jennifer also mentioned the work of Sue Lida, looking at telone as a soil fumigant. So this is what it boils down to. You're looking at something to kill the fungus in the soil before it hits the plant. And this is the challenge of it. And this slide this is an Erlenmeyer flask, and I'm using it to produce, get the arrow back. This is dead sorghum seed that's heavily colonized by the fungus, which is white here. And what the fungus does is grows into the soil. And you see these strands and see these little enlarged bodies. That's the beginning of the formation of the sclerotia. So if we can use our imagination that this sorghum mass is a cotton plant that's been infected and is dying, and so the fungus is surviving, it's putting strands out into soil to produce the resting sclerotial bodies, except it's not going an inch or so down, it's going several feet down. So again, the problem with treating the soil is treating that whole soil profile where the pathogen can be. So this goes into the next era of fungicide work, protecting the plant itself. And Sue Lida was a pioneer with this, stem drenches of azithromycin fungicides. Also doing work with the sterile inhibitor group of fungicides. And there's been a lot of attention paid to propiconazole, one of the DMI fungicides. Again, Sue Lida pioneered slow-release formulations of propiconazole. Dick Hine in Arizona looked at a side dress with it. And also in Arizona, Mary Olson and Steve George looked at putting propiconazole through the drip system. And actually, they did report some success, but that was in an abstract, and it never was followed through by a paper. So anyways, that's the starting point. I'd also like to acknowledge the work of Dr. John Matoka at the Corpus Christi station. He's been continuing the work with slow-release propiconazole. Back in 1995, I visited his plots in Tynan, Texas. He had a really good location for doing this work where it was uniform infection. And I was greatly impressed by the checkerboard appearance of the field. And these are actually protected by the fungicides compared to the control here. So this impressed me that there is possibility of using fungicides for control. The problem with propiconazole Well, it's a regulatory problem, and the bottom line is that Syngenta, the company that made it back then, said they're not going to support a registration for this particular use. So then this goes into my work, and I'm inspired that the work done by other people working on other crops, for example, Marvin Miller, who did a lot of work controlling a root rot fungus, Monosporastus cannonballus, on melon. And so I'm interested in screening new fungicides, things that have come on the market in the past 10 years or so, for their utility in this, and looking at different application methods, bearing in mind we have to keep this thing economical, and we also have to pay attention to the EPA rules regarding risk cups for fungicides. Of course, this is done backward. This should have been about the first thing I did, but this is actually recent work, screening different fungicides in vitro for activity. And these fungicides comprise different groups. For example, is oxystrobin, is strobilurin fungicides, relatively new on the market. EPA really likes this material, and it's used all over the place, perhaps too excessively, as are some of the other related fungicides like periclostrobin. There's also a fair representation of the triazole fungicides in here, the DMI fungicides. They have the azole tag on it. And I'm not going to go through the whole sequence. What you do is you put different concentrations of the fungicide in the growth media and have the fungus grow on it, and then measure growth as a percentage of what a control plate, no fungicide, would do. At higher concentrations, 1 part per million or 10 part per million, most of these fungicides will inhibit the fungus. I'm interested in very, very small concentrations of fungicides. So here we have 0.01 parts per million. And you can see that I use propiconazole as a reference point, since all the early work's been done with that. And there's some other fungicides, primarily triazoles, that have the same amount of activity. Bosclid is a different class of fungicide, not as good. Azoxystrobin, which seems to be pretty good, and that has been, there's been work done on putting that through a drip irrigation system for controlling Monosporastus root rot. Prothioconazole, which is also a new triazole fungicide, is not as inhibitory. So here's, again, another summary slide looking at the different triazole fungicides in relation to the control. And in vitro, you can very easily show that most of these fungicides will inhibit the fungus, but it goes back to the problem. When you're in soil, how do you get that fungicide past the soil, past particles that'll absorb it, to the point where it can get to the plant and protect that plant from the pathogen? So for several years, I've been evaluating stem drenches. And again, I'm looking at chemicals that the EPA would look fondly upon to ease registration, and things that already had cotton labels. I was particularly focused on stem-directed drenches. So here's a cotton plant that's been pulled out of the soil. Here's the soil line here. You can see the strands of mycelium. So what I was looking at is getting an application of fungicide to this particular area to protect it. Now, also my rationale is, since it's possible nowadays to map out fields and where the root rot is, if you don't have 100% incidence in your field, you could save money by treating only portions of a field. So in some of our earlier experiments, we looked at, in San Patricio County, we made use of handy things like infrared photographs. This is provided by Carlos Fernandez. And you see here this circle, which was probably about 100 feet in diameter. We could find this place year after year based on, if you can see in the photo, where the center pivot road was and the tire tracks. And that's been my early bane, is finding the exact spot where you can find cotton root rot. A lot of times growers don't quite remember where it is. And so we had this in an irrigated plot. This is what the plants looked like when we did our stem drench treatments. And very quickly, and this in South Texas, this disease will progress quite rapidly in June. You can see here the death, but there was some areas where the stem drenches did have an effect. Here's some data from the replicated trials, and point here at the statistical differences. Here is our control, an average of 92% disease incidence, and all these other fungicides. This would be Quadris, which is also used as a seed treatment on cottonseed. Here's our tilt standard, Microbutanol is another fungicide that's used for on cotton, and diophenate methyl, which is also another old standby. So there are some differences. So this is very encouraging. However, I point you to here the rate, 1¾ pounds per acre in a volume of 429 gallons per acre. So here's a little bit of a problem. The drenches will work, but we're talking literally drench. And the objective is to move it to something that growers could use. So in other later stem drench experiments, I used a bunch of materials, reducing the volume of water to 41 gallons per acre, which is still pretty high. And here's the results from that. This is what the field looked in San Patricio County when we treated it. It was 90 days after planting when we put the stem drench applications on it. Did this experiment in some other locations. This was Tom Green County, a couple fields. These plants were a lot younger than the San Patricio field, 12th true leaf and 7th true leaf. However, after these treatments, here's just a pictorial representation of what happened. Root rot just came in and hit everything. And it really, to see anything, you really do have to count up plants and throw in the numbers. So here's the numbers. I won't really belabor a lot of it. I guess you can focus on towards the end. First of all, the San Patricio County did not see, saw a trend, but no statistical differences. There was a lot of variability in disease incidence. The two Tom Green County locations, looking at the control, 94% incidence 110 days after planting. And there were statistical differences with the materials, but there were still high levels of disease. It's really not a good consolation saying you have a statistical difference, but 3/4 of your crop is showing disease symptoms. Same thing with this other location in Tom Green County, almost 100% in the control, and there were survivors in the other fungicide treatments. Here's the bad news. In spite of all doing all that and getting this really disappointing results, looking at high volumes of water applied, the cost per acre for these materials, for the amount I used, were really, really high. So we're not talking something that's commercially viable. And I've concluded from this sort of approach that if we had fungicides that translocated downward in the plant, we might have a better chance of it. But for all these fungicides I've tested are what's known as xylomobile. That is, they'll move from the root up with the water. We don't have anything that's active against this fungus that moves downwards. That could mean a whole world of difference. And I've not heard of anything in the pipeline that works like that. I'll review 2006 stem drench experiments, different locations, screening different fungicides, again, trying to lower the volume of water. Quick summary from San Patricio County, everything's dead. It was very disappointing. In one of the Tom Green County locations, here's our fungicide screen. I could see differences with materials. Here's the control, no fungicide. You can see with propiconazole standard, it's reduced substantially. Some of these others really didn't have much of effect. In fact, that was kind of disappointing. A couple other locations in Tom Green County. This one, at the end of the experiment, really not much of a difference except with propiconazole. Wall, not much of a difference at all. And I was really disappointed with stem drench, and I haven't really pursued it until I've decided what other approach to use. But finally, also at the encouragement of one of the chemical companies, they had some seed treatments they wanted to try, and I thought this is a real long shot because you're talking about a fungicide being put at the time of planting and on the seed and probably playing out by the time the fungus really gets going. Here's the quick results here, and I did as a comparison, propiconazole stem drench, which reduced it compared to the control. Didn't really see much effect of these seed treatment fungicides. So you might use seed treatment fungicides to protect yourself from seedling pathogens, but not phymatoxicum root rot. So this brings me up to the final part that I'm more excited about is putting fungicides through the drip tape. And I really do appreciate the cooperation of John and Doug Wilde for allowing me to use their farm to do the experiments. This is what it looked like the first year, 2006, when we did the experiment. And in parts of their field, they can get a massive amount of devastation from cotton root rot. Now, when I first met Wilde's, we decided to go ahead, and it was kind of short notice to do this project. And I have to admire Doug for being very brave and going into it with a trencher and digging right into his irrigation system and pulling. I mean, this. I'm glad we had a machine to do it, because it'd be horrible to try to dig in that soil by hand to rip open the lines and put in valves. And what we had here were individual lines for each row, so we could treat each row with a different fungicide, we could randomize it, and of course we could replicate it. So this is a super way to do an experiment. We're talking about several hundred feet of row, too, just going all the way down. Again, Doug had shown this picture in his presentation. You have the fungicide in this, it's being pumped through into one line at a time. And of course, we bought additional pumps so we could do a couple lines at a time, and this really speeds things up. Also have little weather stations planted to look at soil temperature and moisture and all that to monitor that. Close up of the pump and the valve, so we can turn it off, turn it on. So one of the things I was evaluating, wilting, so this counts, this plant here counts as infected, as do the dead plants. So here's the results from our 2006 work. The incidence average of 4 reps per 200 row feet. And just counting the amount of diseased plants in that, it's not really a percentage. We really didn't see any big differences. There's a lot of variability here. But we did look at a whole several different fungicides. Again, the propiconazole standard and the thofenate methyl standard, but some of the new triazole fungicides plus Quadris. In this experiment, it didn't work, and we probably were too late. In fact, we were already starting to see symptoms of root rot in the field. I think that might have been one of the problems. In 2007, according to the calendar, we applied it earlier at the time of flowering, but I still think we were probably a little on the late side. And you can see here with this batch of chemicals, and this is the pounds of active ingredient per acre shown here, but you really didn't have any significant disease differences. So that's where I've left it there. We need to do more work on improving the timing, I think just getting earlier in there. I'm still focusing on trying to reduce the cost and looking at rate, but we need to get something that works first. It's a little bit of a handicap having to go out to San Angelo, and it's a long drive, 5 hours, but it's worth it with good cooperators. Temple is very close to College Station, and this is where they did pioneering work in root rot. They are out of cotton. They say, well, if you bring your own cotton equipment, you can start up doing work. So next year I'm planning actually to do some work at the Stiles Farm in Thrall, which is only about 1.5 hours from College Station. I would like to keep it on an experiment station or do some work there. There's logistical reasons for that. And also being close, I could monitor it more closely. And so that's where it's left. And again, I'd like to thank all the grower cooperators that let me, let our group do this work to try to help them out. Thank you. Okay, yes. Tom Fox has asked about those few odd plants in areas of root rot areas that are still alive. The breeders thought about this a long time ago, and they pulled them out, and they would check them in the lab and find they're still susceptible. So it's probably an escape for some reason or another. Just the fungus never made it there. Yeah. This work is really empirical, so no, and I'm trying to collect that sort of information. So, yeah, we could stand for more work done in that area. There's a whole bunch of things we could do. And so, like, the take-home message here, don't run out and buy any of these chemicals and put them on your field. And for one thing, they're not labeled for this use.
I've got a question. You know, the earliest work you showed that you did with the stem branches was the most successful, if I remember your numbers.
Yes, that's correct.
You made some really substantial reductions with that. You moved away from that volume of water, which is a reasonable volume, actually a light, very light volume, even with the center pivot system, to being very low volume. So do you have any ideas if the volume of water was actually what was so critical in those early studies, moving the material much deeper because of the large volume of water, as opposed to the typical little 40 gallons per acre?
Yeah, I think it really was the volume of the water. Because I didn't show earlier work things I did in the 1990s. And that was also, we saw very good trends, and we're using very large, I mean, we're talking literally drenching the soil around
with,
there.
With precision ag, there is the ability to program pivots now. I mean, it's not necessarily cheap, but you can make applications through pivots in a precision ag manner. I mean, that can be done on a span basis within, let's say, a couple of degrees. So you could actually program a pivot to apply chemicals at fairly precise points around the circle, and that would get you away from the volume and water issues. Yes, Jim?
Well, yeah, it is. It's a matter of getting it down. It's not getting down very deep. It's maybe a couple inches or so, like around the lower stem.
40 gallons of water barely washes it off the plant.
Yeah. No. The other there's another issue with drip tape. In this case, in the experiment, the drip tape was right under the plants. A lot of growers have put the drip tape in between the rows or in the middle of the rows. So that might also affect the activity of furrows. No, I had a backpack sprayer, took the actual nozzle off, and so I'd have this wand and put it out. It's directly on the stem, so we're talking really inefficient. And later on... Yeah, it's a matter of having to go through that canopy, whereas we were doing our drenches, we were right there where it needed to go and squirting out.